This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Here in downtown Chattanooga, at the corner of Georgia Avenue and Market Street, there's a public space where people like to gather outside Patton Towers. The Porch Project is a collaboration to improve that space, make it healthier, more welcoming, more functional for the people who use it most. A pilot project that relies on their input and feedback.
Good people around here, we're trying to keep it straight. And I'm one of the volunteers to help him with the painting. I'm trying to keep everything respectable and stuff, and manageable and things. And I'm gonna do what I can do to try to keep our project going.
The Chattanooga Design Studio is part of the team of local organizations steering the Porch Project and working with residents. Lindsay Wilkie is urban design coordinator at the studio, and Beverly Bell is an urban designer there. Lindsay, Beverly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much.
What is it about this corner of Market Street and Georgia Avenue that makes it so, on the one hand, it's densely populated, but on the other hand, it is the most sociable place in that part of downtown?
Yeah, it's a really unique public space in our city. So when we talk about public spaces, we think about, I think people typically think of parks like Miller Park or waterfront, but sidewalks are some of our biggest public spaces. And in 2018, the studio, in partnership with Enterprise Center, did a study where we had about 70 volunteers, and we counted and measured for over the course of 2 days the number of people that are spending time in our city center, loosely defined by the Innovation District. And this corner at Georgia and Market Street rose to the top in our data as one of the most actively, not only one of the most actively used public spaces, but one of the most sociable public spaces. So by sociable, I mean there are people spending time in groups of two or more for over the course of periods of time, you know, not just passing through the space, but really spending time on this corner. And Patton Towers is an income restricted residential neighborhood in our, we've been referring to it really as a vertical neighborhood. It's one of the most dense residential buildings really in all of our downtown. There's close to 200 people that live in this building. And so you think of this vertical neighborhood in the heart of our city, and this sidewalk is really a porch space. And so it's this interesting kind of confluence of both businesses nearby that are passing through, but also it's, you know, someone's front porch that lives downtown day to day. And so from an urban design standpoint, it's also kind of geographically at an interesting point in our city. Georgia Avenue is this kind of ceremonial street that cuts through our downtown. And so at this nexus of Georgia and Market Street is where our two grids come together. So you think about just from the flow of our city, it's also a really interesting location. It's a block away from our central Miller Park. It's a block away from our library. The EDNY, the Innovation Center, is right across the street. And so there's an interesting dynamic from a geography of the location and also the social dynamics of that corner.
And when it comes to the Porch Project, as it's called, it is all at its core about listening to the people who live there. Tell us more about that process.
We really started this project by listening. So it started with coffee talks that were started September of last year, where we, our core project team, which is Chattanooga Design Studio, Chattanooga Department of Transportation, the YMCA of Metropolitan Chattanooga, the Downtown Public Library, and Patton Towers. And we started out by just going out on the sidewalk and putting a table out there and having free coffee, pastries, bagels, and inviting people to just stop by, say hello, and start to form relationships. And we started off by just kind of asking how their day's going. We started and then kind of evolving into asking about how they felt about the space. We did surveys. We did just a lot of really interesting interactive ways of gathering information from people about how they felt about the space, what they envisioned about how it could improve, and just really how they wanted their outdoor front porch to feel. And that kind of evolved into once we hired the design team, one of the key components we wanted on that team was a artist who was able to very creatively engage people through some community engagement efforts, and that was Genesis the Gray Kid. So he led several different sessions called Words in Gray, where he asked people to write a poem about how they felt about the space. He led people in exercises where they sketched about what they thought the space could look like. And all these efforts were just opportunities to listen to the people that use this space every day and really make this project tailored to their specific needs, their specific want, and so that this space was made with them, not for them.
And for these residents, it's probably the first time that they encountered not only an outreach, but an artistic process like this.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's been a really interesting process. One, and just the project team side, that there's about six partners working on this project together. And so we bring together kind of this wide skill set of both interests and resources that we all bring to the table. But then, yeah, our very, very first meeting before we even got the project really going, we included the residents to say, you know, what do you even think about this process? Do you think that this space can be transformed even from the way that we perceive this, that people from outside the community perceive this corner to be a more welcoming space for all? And I think there were definitely dissenting opinions even in that first conversation. But it, as Beverly said, it was really all about listening and ultimately relationship building. I mean, there's some really cool renderings that maybe folks have seen of the project, and the final physical manifestation of the project is important. But I don't know, I think one of my former mentors used to say the race is really the prize. And I think that's certainly the case in this project, that while there'll be some beautiful art and benches and plants and flowers out there, the process of this project has been the most important part and will continue to be even after the space is built out by the beginning of November.
You mentioned some of the things that are becoming part of that space: seating, landscape planters. There are other things that are part of this: sidewalk paint, use of color in general, free payphone, free Wi-Fi. All of these things are going into that space.
Yeah, it's going to really transform that corner. I mean, you know, I think someone said, oh, this is going to be one of those Instagrammable moments in our city. And we certainly hope it's more than that. But I don't know. I think the story of the swimming pool is kind of interesting. Do you want to?
Yeah. So in one of Genesis's Words of Gray exercises, where we were doing the sketching, one of the artists, he was getting people to just sketch out what they wanted to see in the area. And he really wanted to see a pool on Georgia Avenue, which is an awesome idea, but not exactly feasible. And so the design team, WMWA, Landscape Architects, and Genesis took that idea and said, well, maybe we can't do a pool on Georgia Avenue, but we can use paint to paint the street blue, make it different shades of blue, give it kind of that pool feeling. And so that's what's been so neat through this whole process, is all of the things that are going out in that space started from the ideas of the residents that were gathered through those sketches or through those words or through those conversations.
Once this installation is complete, that's not the end of the project. The feedback, the engagement with the community, that's ongoing.
Yeah, this is termed a pilot project. And so the point of the project, it's a lower budget project for, you know, a real urban design intervention, but it's meant to really respond to the existing needs of the space, but also to continue to be of learning and adaptation. So the payphone that's not going over well. The residents don't like it. You know what? It can come out. Or, you know what? We need more tables and chairs out here. Or this type of chair, really, people aren't sitting in this chair. Let's think about getting that other type of chair that people are using. And there's so many ways for us to learn from this space, to adapt it over time, and then to use this process and these things that we learn in other spaces in our city. But we hope the quality of the furniture can certainly stand the test of time. We've got some really beautiful pieces that'll be part of the furniture. And some of the pieces are actually being custom fabricated locally. the wear and tear, it could last over 10 years, but we're really going to kind of set a 2-year period to do follow-up surveys and see the qualitative feedback on the space from residents, and also continue some of the, I mentioned the original study that pointed to this space as a highly sociable corner. How does this intervention either improve, hopefully improve that space for even more sociability?
How have you had to adjust the space, if at all, due to life under COVID-19?
Luckily, the space was designed to be very flexible and very adaptive. And so in our eyes, we haven't had to change the design really at all. Our whole process has been delayed due to, unfortunately, install factory shutdowns that extended the period that the furniture would be able to get here. But the furniture itself is movable, so residents will be able to create a more distanced social environment there than they have now.
And then where can people go online to follow the progress to continue to give feedback?
So you can follow Chattanooga Design Studio either on Facebook or Instagram. One of the key project partners we're thinking about the activation and use of that space will be Bingo's Market. And so they will be kind of a hub of activity and life on the street as we finish the project. And so stop by Bingo's Market to check in on the progress of the project, or follow the design studio on social media.
All right. Lindsay, Beverly, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been fun.
Native turtles in this country face many threats to their habitats. Poaching, trafficking. Zoos, aquariums, and nature centers are partnering on ways to save turtles together. Here in Chattanooga, turtle expert Dave Collins is director of forests and animal behavior at the Tennessee Aquarium. Mark McKnight is president and CEO of Reflection Riding Arboretum and Nature Center, and Tish Gailmard is director of wildlife there. Mark, Dave, Tish, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ray.
Thanks, Ray.
Tell us more about this partnership.
Give you a little background on what this American Turtle Safe program is. It is a formal program of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. I think, and the Safe programs are really have become the flagship conservation programs of the AZA. They've taken what have been the species survival plans, and still are, but they've taken SSPs to a new level. In fact, within the American Turtle Safe, we are actually embracing 5 different SSP programs. So it really does emphasize partnerships. You know, it does focus on the partnerships between various zoos of AZA, but the real beauty of this program is that it really encourages AZA zoos to reach out into the much broader conservation community and forge partnerships with, you know, a number of partners that we certainly have worked with together, like us in the Nature Center and Reflection Riding. We've known each other for years, but it gives us an opportunity to, I think, to really push this to a brand new level. So it's a lot of really exciting opportunities. Just in terms of scale of this program, we were formally approved by AZA in February. And despite the challenges we've had this year, when we started, we had 13 founding partners, and we're up to over 25 zoo and aquarium partners now, and over 30 field partners, ranging from U.S. Fish and Wildlife to many state agencies to organizations like Reflection Riding and a number of academic institutions. So it's really taken off, and we're getting a lot of good progress. It's an exciting project.
Mm-hmm. How does this partnership work between the aquarium and Reflection Riding?
Within our SAFE program plan, we have a number of strategic objectives. One of those we call our conservation colonies. And these are groups of animals that maybe from confiscations that are not ready to be released or may not be releasable. But we're looking for where do these animals go next, where they can really become involved with really meaningful conservation efforts. And then within that objective, we've split between developing programs with zoos and aquariums, but also we've started a regional parks initiative where we can reach out to nature centers, botanical gardens, county and state parks, and really broaden the whole scope of this program. And this is where we're connecting with Reflection Riding. You know, a great way to look at this is the aquarium has got a lot of infrastructure, a big building. We've got very good animal care staff, but we are real estate poor. When we look at the nature center, you have a beautiful site, and we're looking at opportunities to bring these two resources together I'm confident that we will more than double the resources when we put the program together. Mm-hmm. That's what brings us together. One of the five species that the SAFE program includes is our eastern box turtle. It was brought in for a number of reasons. It's not as threatened or endangered as the other species we're looking at, but it has the dubious distinction of being probably the most heavily traded North American turtle in the illegal wildlife trade. We're seeing thousands of box turtles leaving the country every year. It's also a turtle that so many of our visitors are familiar with. So it's just a great ambassador to really bring a lot of these important messages about protecting our native wildlife. Like I say, it's an animal that people relate to. It's tangible. In fact, the wild box turtles live right there on Reflection Riding, and we can take the message from the wild turtles to these turtles that we're recovering and hoping to bring back into the conservation picture. So there's just so many really great connections we can make.
And Mark and Tish, tell us more about those connections working out there at Reflection Riding.
Sure. One of the things that I've always loved about this property and about really Lookout Mountain as a whole is that on any particular hike, you're going to find all kinds of different things. And there's always something different in every season to see. And around this time of year, and especially in the summer too, it's hard to hike more than about a half a mile without running into a box turtle. And it's always such a special experience. They have these beautiful eyes. There's a connection that I think is fairly natural with humans and animals like this. And of course, we're always encouraging people to come and see the Red Wolf program that we're a participant in. And that's, as Tish mentioned, is also a SAFE program through the AZA. And it's a similar thing, I think, when you're face-to-face with a wolf, you really come to understand that animal and respect it. And there's a deep kind of connection that's innate in us with these animals. And it's hard to articulate it, but it's a very deep connection that people feel. And our hope is that we can do something similar to what we're doing with the Red Wolf, where we may, for example, end up having an enclosure where we have some of these box turtles that have been recovered from the illegal wildlife trade. And we may have those on site somewhere that we can go and take school kids and have visitors come in and have that experience face to face. We do have one box turtle right now. I'll let Tish talk about the one that we have in captivity right now.
Yeah, we actually have one box turtle that lives with us. She was actually injured from a weed eater and is missing a foot, and she was deemed non-releasable. So she's been with us a couple of years now, 2 or 3 years now, as a non-releasable box turtle. And we use her in education programs. And for me, the box turtle it's one of those animals that, like Dave said, most everyone can relate to. Most everyone knows a box turtle. You see them, you remember them from your childhood, but you might not know a lot about them, and you particularly might not know that they're being illegally traded. I think when I talk to people about that, that's something they are not aware of at all, and something we certainly need to bring to everyone's attention, and why you shouldn't be trading any wildlife or holding any wildlife as a pet. It's really critically important. And I think we can do a great job between the aquarium and us getting that message out. And, you know, we're this awesome field station for the aquarium. We've got all this beautiful property where we can house these turtles and make this program really wonderful.
And Dave, you were saying that the aquarium is real estate poor relative to Reflection Riding. In terms of social distancing, in terms of people staying safe during the pandemic, it's a lot easier for folks to feel comfortable to go out to Reflection Riding and see a turtle out in the wild.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. There are a lot of challenges we have today that are new for us, and we're struggling to try to figure out how to best address them. For example, we meet on Zoom calls like we are today. It's a tremendous challenge, but we want to look for any silver lining. It may be that we're learning a little bit more about good ways to relate to people. And if we could do anything we can to bring more people outdoors and take more of our message outdoors and let them really, really feel that experience, I think that's a huge win.
And turtles have been the focus of the aquarium this entire year because of how unique they are, how they have been under threat in so many ways, including the illegal trade that we talked about earlier.
That's right. Yeah, we designated this year as the year of the turtle, renovated our turtle exhibit that actually had been in place for about 20 years. And so we felt it was time for a little renovation. But we took that opportunity to really focus on these conservation issues and both the illegal trade. And so we kind of just stepped through the whole process that basically how wonderful turtles are, but turtles are in trouble, and what are we doing about it? And finally, what can you do about it? Trying to give our guests messages about what they can do in their day-to-day lives to improve the lot of turtles. And certainly an experience out in the field with the free-ranging wild turtles is, it really takes that message home.
Yeah. And another thing I think people aren't aware of, I always think about what can I educate someone about a particular species that they may not know. And most people don't know that turtles brumate. They technically aren't active in the winter. And that's something that a lot of people like to learn about, and they refer to it as hibernation, and we can help them understand the term brumation. And there's just a whole lot of really cool information about turtles that people aren't aware of. So when you talk to people about illegal turtle trade, and then you can also provide all these wonderful educational messages of why turtles are critically important and what they do for our ecology.
One kind of interesting story, and I'm always trying to get people to slow down on Garden Road because it's a very narrow road and it is a residential road as well. But one of the things that we can do is slow down and watch for turtles, especially when they get really active and start moving around. And I actually had a story. I was leaving for lunch from out here at Reflection Riding, was going down about halfway down Garden Road. There was a box turtle, and it was right where your wheel would go. I mean, it was sitting, wasn't moving. It was in its shell, and I was able to stop, got out and checked on it, and it was bleeding. It had been nicked just a little bit, probably by a car. It probably went right in between two car wheels as it was trying to cross the road. And I was able to take it and get it to a rehabilitator, and they glued up the shell carapace, is what you call it. And that one was releasable back into the wild and would probably be fine. But I think it's important to know what to do when you come across a turtle like that. And we have a lot of people who call us with injured animals. We don't do rehab on site, but we do have a whole network of rehabbers. So we can, depending on what the animal is and what the problem is, we can get you in touch with the right person. But in this case, I think just slowing down and being aware is a really important step that you can do, especially when you're in these protected natural areas around Lookout Mountain or some of the places on Signal Mountain where they may be crossing the road.
And if people want more information so they can see for themselves, where can they go?
Well, they can certainly go to the Tennessee Aquarium website. You know, to learn more about the SAFE programs, I'd recommend that they just go to AZA SAFE, and they'll get a lot of information about the overall SAFE programs there.
Yep. And then, of course, reflectionriding.org. We're going to be publishing regular updates as we move along. And we're actually in a master planning process right now. And my hope is, like I said, to end up with some kind of turtle experience as part of that. And then we're actually taking that message out to the larger Nature Center community as well.
All right, Mark, Dave, Tish, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ray.
Each week online, the Bessie Smith Cultural Center here in Chattanooga features community members reading children's books to spur dialogue on race relations. The digital series is called Bessie's Front Porch, and last week, the center's president, Paula Wilkes, read The Other Side by Jacqueline Woodson.
That summer, the fence that stretched through our town seemed bigger. We lived in a yellow house on one side of it. White people lived on the other. And Mama said, "Don't climb over that fence when you play." She said it wasn't safe. That summer, there was a girl who wore a pink sweater. Each morning, she climbed up on the fence and stared over at our side. Sometimes I stared back. She never sat on that fence with anybody. That girl didn't. Once when we were jumping rope, she asked if she could play, and my friend Sandra said no, without even asking the rest of us. I don't know what I would have said. Maybe yes, maybe no.
Watch the entire readings from Bessie's Front Porch on the Facebook page and YouTube channel for the Bessie Smith Cultural Center. The next reading appears online at 11 a.m. tomorrow. You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots talking writing. Our guest again this week is Kim McLean, singer, performer, songwriter, teacher, label owner. As the poet Walt Whitman put it, "I contain multitudes." Certainly it's true of Kim McLean, whose biggest challenge is finding the time to pursue all of the projects and initiatives she has in mind, some of which we touched on in this part of our conversation. We started out talking about her most recent album, which would have been a double album on vinyl. Titled Shadows on Light, it showcases both the secular and the sacred sides of her writing and her life. She has written very successful songs for a number of gospel acts, as well as for a wide range of secular singers, including Betty Levette, Loretta Lynn, Jennifer Hansen, and Tim McGraw.
Well, I've been Grammy nominated in two genres. I've been Grammy nominated in Christian music and in country music. It felt like those two worlds are very opposite or very different, very distinct. There are people who will make statements in the entertainment world if they know you're Christian or if you tout your Christian faith, specifically Christian, not just spirituality, but Christian. You get branded a certain way, and they would encourage you in the secular, in the non-Christian genres, not to emphasize that Christian faith. I would have booking agents and managers tell me they wouldn't work with me if I wanted to work in the Christian field because they said they just didn't admire that. We don't really have to go into all of that, I suppose. And in the Christian field, they often wouldn't want to work with you if you were going to have songs in what they call the secular field. Well, to me, it's all God. It's all, that broke my heart. But I started learning to censor what I said. And then that felt fake to me. And as we said earlier, I'm not very good at faking it. And I'm not a very good actress. I didn't like having to hide. It felt like in some circles I was expected to hide part of who I was. With this project in particular, I decided to be all of it. And I did do CD1 and CD2, and I made a line of distinction there. And I did that to soften the blow, really, for some of my Christian colleagues. Soften the blow. I know that probably sounds like a harsh way to say that, but I felt like the way I needed to do that, to say, hey, I still sing and write these country songs that deal with issues of broken relationships and sexuality and life's challenges, and I still love Jesus. So, yes, this project brought us to what has been described to me as two different worlds, and it was my way of saying it's all one world to me. I would like to own it all. You know, I'm going to put this out there, and if you're uncomfortable with my Christian faith or with my worldliness, then maybe I'm not the artist for you.
That seems so weird to me because you've had huge gospel music hits. Mm-hmm. And people realize it's the same person, right? That's writing that, that's writing the secular songs.
They do, but they never had me come and perform my own songs on any of those Bill Gaither Down Home.
You can live in both worlds as a writer, but not as a performer.
Right. That's what I have found to be true. Now, it could. I like to own responsibility for my own life journey. I don't like to feel like, I just feel like it's good to own it. So it could be that I didn't knock on those doors, or maybe I kept them at arm's length without realizing it. But I do know that I have, you know, I'm certainly not a victim of the industry or anything like that, but I don't feel like I missed out in any way. I have thought a time or two of calling Bill, because Bill Gaither walked up to me at an event one time. I was so shy. I'm terrible. I'm not just terrible at putting on wigs and enough makeup and getting bodily enhancements so I can be on the stage. I'm not good at that sort of, to my mother's chagrin, I'm not a foo-foo girl. I'm not any better at some of the social settings. I like to be the fly on the wall at the parties. I like to take it in and observe. But Bill Gaither walked up to me, and I thought, oh gosh, Bill Gaither's walking up to me. And he walked directly up to me, and he said, I'm so happy to meet you. I just want you to know that I'm aware that you have single-handedly changed the sound of gospel music, and I bet you don't even know that. And he said, but you changed the way we did things with your writing. Well, I didn't know that, and I didn't ever go to the parties, and I thought, well, and then he walked off, and one of my friends said, oh my gosh, do you know who that was? I said, yes, okay, they're right. Yes, do you hear what he just said to you? I said, yes, but it's not going to do me any good unless he says it in a magazine that gets published, or unless he has me on his show. Well, unless he writes with me, and he didn't say it to anyone else out loud. He said it to me. And I thought, okay, well, I can, sure, if I go say it in an interview now, well, I'm saying it in an interview now. But it's like, sure, right, Bill Gaither said that to you. But yes, he did, but I wasn't recording it. You know, it's like I get this little personal triumph moment, and it feels good, but he didn't have me on his show that I've been paid for all of my songs. He said dozens of my songs have been performed on his videos. But he had the artist who recorded them on his videos. And I thought about calling him and said, why don't you let me come sing one sometime? Because surely he knows how to find me. But I never called and asked, could I do this? And I think I maybe enjoy having the best of both worlds.
This song was a huge hit with the Christian music trio Sierra, written by Kim McLean It's called No Stone to Throw.
Maggie lives on 2nd Street, downtown by the river. She looks away from everyone she meets. They've got no time to give her.
I don't see you as a victim, but at the same time, I think that what we've just been saying sort of reinforces what you were saying earlier, that there's a definite line between performer and writer.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to be, you know, the different rules apply to each.
Right, and Bill does both. Now, Bill Gaither does, of course, is known as he's a copyright writer in Christian music. He's and also an artist. Has helped a lot of writers and artists along the way as well. I'm launching my own company now because I want to help writers and artists along the way. But I love making my own CDs, and I've got some new recordings that I'm about to release. I let a lot of time go by since I did this Shadows and Light album, and I'm ready to get out and say something again now.
I do think it's interesting that you have also assumed the producer's role, and I'm wondering, given the perspective that you have and the insights and the experience that you have, when you come to work with female performers, what do you say to them?
Working with female performers as a producer, I've had the opportunity to work with artists who became great friends, and that's really the only way it could work, because I am an artist. It can be tricky working with, you know, I'm a better producer because I'm an artist. I'm only a producer because I'm musically trained and I am an artist.
Well, it's also said that, you know, you have this reputation for helping these young artists find their voice, as they put it, that you have a gift for that, you know?
Yes, I have a gift for it. And the challenge for me is I have to stay, in some of those cases, I have felt like I needed to stay off the topic of my own artistry so that I could be really only encourage them as an artist. That was uncomfortable for me because, again, it feels like hiding part of who I am. So I've wanted to work with artists who were secure enough in themselves to let me be the artist I am and help them as an artist as well.
It's a complicated relationship, I would think, isn't it? Because you're a producer, you have your voice, you have your point of view. They are a young artist attempting to develop their voice and their point of view. And somehow you have to find a fusion where you can both kind of express yourselves within that, whatever you're creating, right?
Fusion is a good way to say it, and there has to be great trust. Some of my favorite albums I've produced, Shanna Morrison, her father is Van Morrison. She's one of my dearest friends, one of my closest friends. Producing her album, we wrote together for a lot of it, and then she did some songs that I wrote that we didn't co-write. She's just so confident in her own artistry and what she's doing, and she respected me as an artist as well, and knew that that fusion could happen and that my artistry would not get in the way of wanting her to shine. You know, there's no threat there, no competition there, and that makes it better.
Hey, baby, you're out of touch. Here I go. And yes, I'm gonna slam the door. This time it's not.
And then Eve Stelis is another one. And something Eve likes to say that I like to quote her as saying is that if you take two candles and you put them in a dark room, the room shines all the more brightly. The candles don't take away from one another's light. It just makes more light. And she's one of my dearest friends. I also produced an album for Lisa Brokop, and there was confidence there. And, you know, because you can't, it doesn't serve the artist you're producing if you hide, try to pretend that you're not an artist in your own right. We have to be able to get on the stage and perform together and be equally great. I think that's very important. And it can be tricky. There have been, in the Nashville scene, sometimes it seems like along the way, there were opportunities for me to produce when the artist was threatened by my being an artist. They would want to find a voice through me, and I have a really good stage presence, so they would want to start holding their guitar the way I hold it, or their manager would start saying, move the way Kim is moving up there, do that thing that Kim is doing there. And a couple of them would say, oh, could you record the demo? I want to copy the way you're singing it. Well, that turns it into something that's uncomfortable for both of us. That happened on a couple of different occasions, and I moved away from those situations because it crossed an ethical line and a self-respect line for me that made me uncomfortable.
What do you mean? You feel like you're sort of co-opting their persona?
Yes, co-opting where they were borrowing my move, my sound, and if they gave me credit for that, fine, but if it was taking it and owning it as their own, when I was making records too, that's not imitation in that sense. Didn't feel like a high form of flattery.
Well, and, at the same time, artists are notorious magpies, aren't they? I think Dylan said, you know, don't borrow, steal. I mean, I'm sure he's not the first person to say that.
Right. I wasn't very comfortable with that. The artists would be innocent. Like, as I started getting older, I was too old for them to offer me a record deal. So there'd be a young girl they wanted to offer a record deal who was younger and prettier than me. But I was making records and wanted to become an indie artist. And it could get cross the line into being somewhat insulting. I feel a humility and humbleness. But I wasn't willing to lay down my dignity when it felt like that to me, whether they meant to do it or whether it was inadvertent. It would be these conversations happening as though I wasn't in the room, and there I sat. And I wasn't going to be getting paid for that. Or there were things where it started not only affecting my sense of what I was there to do, but it also affected me monetarily, and that crossed a line that felt unfair to me. But, you know, we're in charge of our own careers. There's never a need to have grudges or to stay in situations we're unhappy with. You see that happening, and you say, you know what, this is for someone else to do because I'm an artist. I'm still an artist. And I can help make you a great artist, but I still get to be a great one too. And we can all win. You don't have to talk about me like I'm not in the room.
On Scenic Roots, this is Talking Writing. Our guest is songwriter and singer Kim McLean. From the album Shadows and Light, this is a song called Somebody Must Be Praying.
Somebody must be praying. Somebody must be lifting me up. Somebody must be praying. I feel the hand of the Lord covering me. I feel the hand of the Lord. In this world, there are trials, but I know I don't walk alone. Say grace and sweet forgiveness. Are leading me, healing me, keeping me strong. Oh, somebody must be praying. Somebody must be lifting me up. Somebody must be praying.
Let's all give credit where credit's due, because I want to be an encourager that way. That's why I wanted to start my own company. It was because I am an encourager.
And yes, you are. And, you know, the first thing that strikes me from what you're saying is people don't listen with their eyes, because that's all about marketing, right? And we both know that that's what, about a 3-year window, and that's it, you're done. If that's what you're playing off, what you look like will carry you for a couple of years, a generation, basically, and then that's it.
Yeah.
Whereas somebody like yourself, who's been making music for almost a lifetime, you're still making music and people are still listening to it. And I think that's a big difference.
Yeah.
But it's one that the music business, quote unquote, often ignores, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it's the same. When you're behind the scenes as a producer, when I went from being someone who was being pursued as a new, unseasoned writer, you know, they realized I was a much bigger moneymaker by writing for everyone because I was so prolific and am so prolific. But I aged out of the category of major record deal and someone they could not pursue. So then they started pursuing me as a producer and giving me those opportunities. You start hearing some of the conversations behind the scenes and you start putting two and two together, or I did, an approaching middle-aged female hearing the conversations, or they're having the conversations with me, and I thought, oh my gosh, you were saying those things about me when I was young, weren't you? Then you realize I was just a poster girl for you. I don't know if we think that people forget that as they get older, you don't care as much, but I'm sort of a timeless person in my spirit, and so I'm still as young as I've ever been, and I'm already as old as I'm going to be. I live in this eternal mindset, and I love that. I think that's how we have wisdom, is we keep this childlikeness and we respect our old age before we get there, and we're all everything in between. Some of these sexist comments.
Thank you so much for saying that. I'm gonna take that home. I've wrestled with that all the time. I'll be 70 years old on my next birthday, and I just don't think of myself that way. I feel like you do. I'm not sure how old I am. I just am who I am, you know?
I know. Have you ever been doing a thing and you're just happy, gleeful, and you have this emotion that's similar to same emotion, you're the same person you've always been, and then you walk past the mirror and you think, who's that?
Yeah, I can relate to that one for sure.
That's
yeah.
So weird.
Well, the cool thing is, though, with all of the insights that you have gained, wow, you're going to be a great label boss, I would think. These young musicians who are coming to you are going to be able to draw on so many different aspects of your experience, and you can help them beyond, you know, the purely artistic, what they do in the studio.
Yeah, that's true.
And is it working out that way? Because you've been label head for a while, right?
I really just have been laying low, and I'm just about to relaunch. Actually, so my label is HCT Media, and my brand is Hippie Chick Twang. I'm just now beginning to relaunch it, and my original vision for it, yes, it has existed for several years, but I've been doing a makeover, if you will. So I'm a music company, but I'm a music and lifestyle company. Yes, I'm an indie label. I have publishing and releasing music with artists like myself and Sherry Cothran. I'm not a publishing and record label in the same sense of being in competition with Music Row. I'm designing a new thing. You know, I could comp just as easily as with the Life is Good organization that sells the T-shirts and the hats and the attitude. That's why this was born. But I do have all of these resources. So I have a spectrum of artists that are of my caliber, Sherry's caliber, who have been doing this for a long time, and we're professional artists who've been in the big time. But then I'm also a teacher, you know. I'm the director of the songwriting program at Tribeca University. So I have these teaching resources, and I teach in my own business. So my company, the Hippie Chick Twang website, is about to open. Right now, if you click on hippiechicktwang.love, you see a holding place, which I'm hoping is launched within the next week or two. I've been working furiously on it. furious, not angry, furious with great energy. And it will have everything from representing the indie artists and launching the music and a platform for the music, but it's a partnership with the artist. So Sherry will own her own masters to her project. So I did not foot the bill or provide the capital for her record. She owns that, but I'm in partnership with her. And to help her, I want my motto is connecting creative people with creative power. And that power is giving them the resources that I have, this 30-year career of resources and networking and expertise and consultation, the resources of the label, the resources of the creative community. I have a Hippie Chick Twang is a creative collective. And it's also the resources of the branding. A Hippie Chick Twang is an attitude. It's a vibe. It's a positivity vibe. It's a way you dress. It's a community of inspiration. But it's also the resources of the power within you.
This is Scenic Roots. Our guest this afternoon on Talking Writing was Kim McLean. The Hippie Chick Twang Love website she mentioned is up and running. To close, this is the title song from her most recent album, Shadows and Light. Thanks for listening.
The pilgrim in my soul, you never try to hold me down, you don't live to control me, and I love you for it, baby. You ain't afraid of my darkness, wrap it around you like velvet. I can fall asleep beside you, trust you with my secret. You're my safe place where I run to find my grace. You're my north star in the night. I give you my life, my shadows and
I am a motivational speaker. I am a spiritual person. There's a menu on the label that is for spiritual practice, you know, and groups that can meet, whether you're a Christian group or whether you're a motivational spiritual group, whatever your faith expression is, where we meet. I've got one right now that meets on Tuesday night, and it's just to help you get your stride in that moving forward and that thing that empowers you from within to keep this going. The perspective that is the wisdom that I have gleaned from working with Betty and Mamie and Dolly and Loretta.
Well, let me tell you, since you just brought up Betty, that clearly Betty was right. You have grown into who you are, and a business mm-hmm. that didn't really see you or get you at all, you are now in a position where you can make that business into who you are rather than the business trying to make you into what they are. And I think that's I think that's wonderful that that's happened. And that takes a great deal of courage and drive and insight to be able to reach that point.
Yeah, it does. Thank you for noticing. And, you know, it can really make the industry. I've had a couple of occasions when, I mean, I guess calling it, referencing it as the industry, it's really just a couple of remarks from a couple of people, but I had the idea that it made them angry, certain people angry that I wouldn't fit into the mold. But I tried. I was courageous, that's true, and I have a certain set of values that matter to me. You've got to know what you value, not values as in morals. It is morals, but it's not just that, it's what you value. And I value the self-expression more than that's just something I value. I value, you've got to know. And when it kept coming to choices, I just was not able to fit the credentials they needed me to fit quite the same way. Going back to my college degree as an example, that took time and resources. And I could have been spending that time with finding booking agents and managers. And I didn't.
Did you publish your thesis?
I did. But I would like to take that now and reframe it in the way that I talk.
Yeah, because I think it would make a heck of a book. I mean, you know, just the insight you offered when you came here last time that most songwriters are neurotic. That's kind of an interesting insight, you know, and it tells you a lot, you know, if you really want to delve into it.
Yes, it's true. Challenging to find the thing to focus on. The reason I haven't hit the ground running was, okay, I finished my pieces. Okay, now I'm going to do this. I'm going to run this label. I really had to put my record label and my company, my music company. I had to chuck it away and be kind of the wizard behind the curtain for a while so that I could decide, how do I want to do this? What do I want to present to the world? How can I best serve the world? Because there are too many choices and I can't do everything. I want to do it what I do well. And so I've been just sorting things through. It's like going through a closet full of stuff and saying, okay, which part of this wardrobe do I want to keep and what's it time to let go of now? I've got to get definition. I've got to get clarity. And so there's the chaos of creativity, and it's scary.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.